On this week's 51%, we speak with author Nanda Reddy about how she grapples with identity and the immigrant experience in her new novel, A Girl Within a Girl Within a Girl.
There's a gradual sense of shedding herself in order to become this person that she, or this ideal that she aspires to, which is quote-unquote American.
Our associate producer, Madeline Reynolds, also catches up with the team behind the musical Respect. This one's for the girls. I'm Jesse King. It's all up next on 51%.
I was standing around like one of those girls I had seen in a movie. The whole world was a movie back then. I had my sunglasses on. I wanted to be seen without seeing Shiloh Alita. I wasn't really in it. I didn't really get it.
You're listening to 51%, a WAMC production dedicated to women's issues and experiences. Thanks for joining us. I'm Jesse King. Today we're talking about identity and the different roles women take on socially and in their personal lives. Our main guest today writes about identity in a very extreme way in her new novel, A Girl Within a Girl Within a Girl. Nanda Reddy is a Guyanese-American writer and former teacher who immigrated to the U.S. legally when she was a child. Her book, however, tells the story of Sunny, an Indo-Guyanese girl who is secretly sent to the U.S. to pose as a couple's deceased daughter and send money back to her family in Guyana. By the time we meet Sunny, she's had to escape her situation and change her name multiple times. She's a grown woman named Maya with a husband and family of her own, but none of them know about her past. It isn't until she receives a sudden message from her sister that Maya slash Cynthia slash Cindy slash Nina slash Sunny is forced to reconcile with the trauma of her childhood, all the parts of herself that she was forced to hide, and all the ways in which she has and hasn't changed. Just a heads up to our listeners that Reddy's book touches on issues like trafficking and domestic violence. If these are subjects that are triggering for you, feel free to leave and come back to us in about 12 minutes. If you or someone you love has been impacted, there are resources available. The National Domestic Violence Hotline is available 24/7 at 1-800-799-SAFE, while the National Human Trafficking Hotline is 1-888-373-7888.
I initially thought it was going to be a story about Maya, the adult Sunny, and that it was going to be her hiding in this cat and mouse game with her husband and her family. And when I delved into the background of why she hid her identity and kind of that story took over. And so the story is mainly a backstory in which you understand why Maya was forced to hide her identity. But I also wanted to touch on this feeling of the parts of ourselves we hide when we assimilate. As an immigrant, you come into a new world and you're the minority, but you're also kind of the less than, and everything, because you've chosen this country or your family chose the country, everything that's new is greater than and is what you aspire to. And so you hide a lot of yourself. You do this code switching thing where you hide a lot of your identity and you learn to erase it, and you also feel it's less than. So I wanted to explore that with this character in which she, you know, there's that self-hate that sort of develops, even though she didn't start out that way when she was in her native country. That is partly why that structure arose. You know, there's reasons, very specific reasons for her changing her identity, for sure. But there's a gradual sense of shedding herself in order to become this person that she, or this ideal that she aspires to, which is quote unquote American.
I mean, the way she comes to the U.S. is pretty traumatic. I mean, she's essentially trafficked at a young age. Her family is told that she's going to live a better life, and she's, you know, sent to live with this couple and pose as their daughter, and it's ultimately very abusive. There's a lot of sensitive subjects here at a very timely period for our nation. I know you're talking about trafficking and domestic violence and illegal immigration. Tell me a little bit about the prep work and research that you had to do for this story. How did you want to approach these subjects?
Okay, so I didn't sit down to write a story about trafficking per se. And when I thought about trafficking, I have to admit I had a naive viewpoint of it, in almost like a movie viewpoint of it, and where people are sold and And of course, she is sold to a degree, but her situation, of course, it is trafficking, it's child trafficking, there's child marriage involved, and it, not in that she was forced to, but they were trying to do that. The way it came about and the research I did for it, I arrived to this country with documents and with papers during a time when there was mass exodus in Guyana. Everyone was leaving Guyana. Guyana was a fledgling republic. It was 15 years post its independence from Britain, and it was just a struggling nation, and there was a lot going on, and so everyone wanted to leave. Our family, we were fortunate, and we were sponsored by my father's brother, who sponsored all of his siblings. But there was this desperation in the country to leave. And so I do know quite a number of people who left the country without documents and who risked, living that way in America for many years. And I did research by, talking to a few of them who would talk to you, because there's still quite a bit of shame around a lot of that. And a lot of people don't want to talk about it because they want to hide it. They don't want that to be out there. But I didn't use anyone's direct experience in writing the story because I wanted it to be a story more about the experience of being an immigrant in that situation and less about the actual immigration. A lot of their stories are actually really striking and scary and like movie made, like they're like stuff from the movies, and I didn't want it to be about that. So I made my character's immigration story, I purposely simplified it. I purposely made it plausible, but so simple that it wasn't actually the main point of the story. And I did that on purpose, partly to protect anyone I researched. I didn't want them to say, "Oh, you told my story," and I didn't want you to. But I also didn't want it to be the main point of the story, because I wanted to get across that feeling of desperation for leaving, which is why Sunny's family—they're not bad people or evil people—but they send her in this very dangerous, circumstance. They send this young girl out to into these hands. They're totally unaware of where she's going to end up. There was a desperation at that time to just leave Guyana and to get into America, this land of milk and honey and opportunity. And I wanted that to come across.
While her immigration story isn't the main point of the story, it does kind of ripple underneath as something she always has to worry about. And, it ultimately makes it a lot harder for her to receive help when her situation turns abusive because, there's always that fear that she'll get deported or that she'll get others around her in trouble somehow.
Yes, I mean, that was one of the feelings I tried very hard to get across, that feeling of being in a no man's land and homeless and where there is no right thing to do. She feels like if she were to, if no matter what she did, there would be consequences that would negatively affect her and other people. And that's often the situation with immigrants who are in that situation. There are ripple effects that go out well beyond just their personhood and their situation and their status. And the fact is that, yes, there's help and there's often resources available to them that they are unaware of, maybe, and also afraid to access with good reason, because even today, I mean, look at DACA, like people went in and they signed up and then it backfired on some people. And so, everyone has a story of where it works out well for someone and where it worked out really poorly for someone else. And so that fear is real. Again, I'm not trying to, with this book, make a statement of this is the right way or that is the wrong right way. I just wanted to show that it's complicated and what it feels like to be in those shoes if someone were curious.
Tell me a little bit about how you decided to navigate these identity and name changes. I thought it was interesting at the beginning of the book, we're years later seeing Maya as an adult and everything is in the first person perspective. But when we head into her backstory, it's all third person. So tell me a little bit more about that decision.
It started that way because I, again, started the story with Maya's frame and Maya's lens, and when Maya looked back at her past, it was with quite some remove. And so she saw herself as a third person. And in some ways, even though she's not the narrator, that's how I started the writing the book, in that she was narrating her childhood story, but through that third person POV. And so that's why that started. And of course, as she shifted and changed, I wanted to show that shift, but then create like a demarcation point where there was a point of no return and she becomes this other person. And there was a lot of tricky things to deal with in on a line and sentence level for sure to accomplish that, especially at the transition point that in some ways was actually sort of fun to write. You're putting yourself in the reader's shoes and you're anyway, and it created a complicated problem for me, which is always sort of a fun thing to solve. But on the other side of it, I wanted it to feel real in that I kind of wanted the reader to see these iterations of self, but also still see Sunny as a whole person. And all and I wanted them to be able to relate too. I mean, we don't go through those sorts of changes where we're like one day called one thing and the other day called a different name or identify with a completely different name. But we do go through these seminal moments where we graduate or we get married, and sometimes we do change our names. And but we do have times when we change ourselves and we make those choices. I remember I embraced the whole goth emo thing in high school, and the first day I showed up with just dressed in all black and kind of wearing makeup was sort of scary because it was a whole new look, but it was me saying, this is who I am now. And we all do things like that as we're exploring our identity and trying to find out who we are. And then, then there's the time when I let it all go, when I said I was no longer that. I want to wear color and makeup and do my hair and making that choice, shifting identities and being allowed to shift identities is a complicated thing. And so I wanted to explore that because we all do that. Everyone does that. And I wanted that to feel relatable, even though her situation is very drastic and different.
Well, I think you do a good job of navigating those transitions and, showing how Maya slash Sunny changes, with there still being that core feeling of, this is the same character that I'm reading about here. And I do think it's really relatable too to have that hesitation to look back on your previous life, to not want to think about your past selves. I mean, my story isn't nearly as drastic, but I think of who I was as a teenager sometimes, and it just physically makes me cringe.
Yes, I wanted readers to identify with that sentiment exactly, and adult readers for sure, because while we were in flux, we have this thing where as an adult, we look back and it's sort of seamless and we're like, oh, we always were. There was the kernel of who we were throughout. And that's true. There's a thread. And with Sunny and Maya, Cynthia, there's a thread of who she is throughout. But we go through these changes. And again, not demarcated quite so drastically, but we look back and we cringe and we do see ourselves as completely, they're different versions of ourselves. I had beliefs at one point where, wrote a manifesto and this was what I believed, and and we needed to do that to become who we are, but we're also always in flux. So there's that, and that Maya is about to change even though she is an adult and she feels fully formed. Identity is just kind of that way. And so, of course, this book touches on so many issues, but I do think identity as a theme is the overarching theme. And I think we can all relate to that.
Nanda Reddy is the author of the new novel, A Girl Within a Girl Within a Girl. It's out now through Zivi Publishing, and you can find it at most major booksellers. And a reminder, if you or someone you love has been impacted by domestic violence or trafficking, please know help is available. The National Domestic Violence Hotline is available 24/7 at 1-800-799-SAFE, while the National Human Trafficking Hotline is 1-888-373-7888.
Thank you.
Our next guests are behind a growing musical celebrating its premiere at two theaters in New York's Hudson Valley. Respect, This One's for the Girls, looks at the many roles of women over the past 100 years through 40 top 40 hits. Written by playwright and professor Dr. Dorothy Marsick, it's based on her book of a similar name, Respect, Women in Popular Music, and directed by Phoenicia Playhouse's Obi Vargas. After wrapping a run at the Rosendale Theater last month, it's now gearing up for a string of performances at the Phoenicia Playhouse. Our associate producer Madeline Reynolds spoke to Marsick, Vargas, and Anne Citrin of the Rosendale Theater to learn more about the show.
Dorothy, my first question is to you. What inspired you to create and write this musical? And if you could, give myself and the listeners maybe a little sneak peek or summary about what this show is about.
Well, the show is the story of women told through top 40 music, from codependent to independent, from Someone to Watch Over Me to I Will Survive. And I was inspired because I was a management professor at Vanderbilt University. It's Music City. And I started using music in my leadership seminars. And then I started to think, and I've always done things on women in management my whole career. So I thought, well, let's look at women in music. So I started doing what we call content analysis research, ultimately of over 2,000 and later 20,000 top 40 songs, to see how women were depicted. And it turns out nobody had done this before. Well, I found, as I said, they went from codependent to independent. And when I would call up the publishers to ask permission to use it, because I started it as a one-woman show, and I actually sang it myself, they would go, oh, we never thought about this, the underlying meaning of the music. And so it opened in Florida in 2004, and it just went crazy. People, they were sold out for 2 months in the first week. And it's played in 100 cities and 2 years off Broadway. And so it's just, it's inspiring, it's uplifting, and it's a lot of fun.
Anne,
yeah.
What made the Rosendale Theater want to bring this show to life on your stage in collaboration with Phoenicia Playhouse? What was that process like?
Well, last December, I went to the Phoenicia Playhouse to see their show, Patsy Cline, Always Patsy Cline. And Ovi had directed it, and I thought, this is fantastic. I really believe in collaboration with other theaters, you know, and so I asked him and his board, and they agreed to bring Patsy Cline there. And then I met Dorothy at the same time, and we just started talking about a possible collaboration again because it worked out so well. And they agreed, and I trusted them implicitly, and that's how it transpired.
Was there a particular part of the show that you were really drawn to and you said, I want this on the stage?
Yeah. Well, I love shows that show strong women, number one. And I also love the idea of a show about the evolution of women in general, but this took it through a musical, you know, direction. And when Dorothy shared with me what she just shared with you, I thought, this is a fantastic thing to bring to our town. We have a lot of women in our audience, and we have a lot of women of a certain age that might really understand and be interested in this subject of how music evolved and how women became empowered. But it's not just for the girls, even though it says this one's for the girls. It's not just for the girls. Men will love it. It's fun. Every song, you know, that I knew growing up, and the choreographer, Liz Pickley, is wonderful. And, of course, Ovi, who is directing the show.
I'm glad that you mentioned Ovi, because my next question is for him. So what is particularly fun and new and exciting about directing this show, maybe from others that you've done in the past? Is there a particular scene that you really enjoyed creating and are fond of?
It's mostly the overall show. It's an unusual show because although it is, you know, technically listed as a musical review, it's really more of a hybrid. It's more like a music review slash musical because there's character development, even though it's short-lived. There are scenes, there are monologues throughout. So it's something that you don't usually find in a musical review, which sort of like borders more on a musical, but it's not quite a musical because the characters don't sustain throughout. So it's a beautiful sort of hybrid. I thought that's my challenge. And also the other challenge is, although this is the music of our lives, it's one of those things where you say to yourself, where was I when this song came out? It's what was I going through when this song came out that allowed this song to be part of my soundtrack. And understanding that, my job is to try to find ways to find deeper meaning within each song so that songs don't just kind of wash over you. When you're listening to our great performers sing these great songs, you go, oh, you know what? I never thought of it that way. Or, oh my God, that's really poignant. All this time, I've known this song for a long time, but now I'm hearing it with fresh ears. Like, oh, wow, this is meaningful to me. And like, I get it now. And so that's my challenge for the show. And, you know, being true to not only these two amazing ladies, you know, Anne and Dorothy, who have given me such faith and trust with this work, but also being true to the women in the show and being there for them and making sure that they look as wonderful as possible. So that's the other challenge. And I'm thrilled to be part of this.
It sounds really interesting, the direction of this show. Is there a particular song or, you know, even the choreography, even though Liz is not with us, is there ways that we showcase the decade through, like, the movement, even the dancing in any way besides the music that we're taking through this journey on?
Oh, for sure. And, yes, you can say that about a lot of the music in this show. But one number in particular that you will really enjoy is These Boots Are Made for Walking.
Love that song.
So it's not just the song, it's the choreography that goes with it. It just really, really rounds it off and brings it home. It's an amazing number.
Dorothy, back to you. You mentioned this in your first answer about how this was a one-woman show. And when I was reading it, I was like, wow, that's really impressive. And you did presentations, and this was received very warmly by audiences. And then this sparked a one-woman show where you performed it, I believe, across the country and in the world, to mention a few, England, Australia, Singapore. Then it blossomed into a bigger production, more cast members, a huge team behind it. So I would love for you to dive deeper into that experience, the way that it grew before your very eyes. And also, I'm curious how audiences received it differently from across the world.
Well, I started out doing singing in my leadership programs. And the first group I did was 100 bankers from the American Bankers Association at their annual conference. The organizer, I had her rent sound equipment and things, and then I got scared at the end. I said, I can't do this. She said, you have to, because I already rented the equipment. So I did this thing about leadership. It was sort of like, well, most leaders want obedient followers. I will follow him. But after a while, they get tired of that. You don't own me. And they want to do themselves. And everybody got it. But at the end, these bankers stood up and gave me a standing ovation. I thought, oh my God, I'm onto something. Then I started to do the women's thing. And again, I did it of Women's History Month. I was going all around the world doing it. And then people said, turn this into a musical. But the most common reply I got from audience members was, I knew the lyrics to those songs, but I never thought about them before. Johnny Get Angry, Johnny Get Mad, Give Me the Biggest Lecture I Have Had, you know, I Want a Caveman, I Want a Brave Man. You're going, what? And, you know, people will come out of the show and say, oh, I can't believe I survived all this music. But it was in our heads. But I added a lot of humor so that you could take some things that were really difficult. And I remember one guy who saw early in Florida, he sent me an email. He said, you changed my life with this musical, because all along I've been angry at my mother because she was so angry. She wanted to be a doctor, but she had to be a nurse. I watched your musical and I understood her. I forgave her. I walked outside and the sky was more blue. I think, how can you do something like that? It's like so amazing to uplift hearts in that way. And initially, I was producing it myself as the four-woman show, and then it got picked up by commercial producers in Florida, and it just took off. And it's been just so rewarding to, I go there and I go, did I write this? You know, and you just see, it's really wonderful to see how it uplifts people.
Yeah, that's amazing. I love that this show is providing new perspectives on songs that we all know and love from several decades, and it's really nice to hear that audience members are coming away with that after seeing the show. Is there a particular song that you think in the show, because there's a lot, that this perspective really hits home for audiences? Is there one, maybe from you as well, Ovi and Dorothy, is there one song or maybe a couple songs that you think you...
I can tell you one thing.
Yes.
When one of our performers sings, I Am Woman, Hear Me Roar, holy crap. It's not only the way it's performed, but where it's placed in the show. It leaves you with such goose pimples. I mean, mm-hmm. it will just stop you dead on your tracks. But there's a lot of moments like that in the show. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of moments like that in the show. And also the number I Will Survive is another mm-hmm. one where you're left like breathless. You know, it's not really just one song. It's the whole journey of music. And then there are moments throughout and scenes throughout. There are some monologues, you know, regarding like the struggles that black women particularly were having. And that leaves you like shaken a little bit. You're like, wow, how this is expressed. And the music that surrounds it. It's just this sort of beautifully structured journey that we take in this, you know, in this production. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I mean, there are a lot of moments throughout.
Yeah. And there's some surprises, too. There was a song that was very popular in 1950 that was followed women having a lot of jobs during World War II and then losing them when the men came back. And so the number one song in 1950 was If I Knew You Were Coming, I'd Have Baked a Cake. And you go, really? That wasn't ironic. That was real. And so just to be able to see that kind of history, and then the song at 17, which is about body image and so on, which was way ahead of its time, it's very poignant, but you're going, oh my God, we really, women had to live through that back then too.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So we've mentioned a lot of songs, but I'm curious, are there more songs that were like soundtracks to your life that are in this show?
I love them all. I think I know the words to every single song in this. I was very touched during rehearsal with Que Sera Sera. Mm-hmm. Not that I love it more than anybody else. It really just, because I know my mother used to sing it to me, and I know a lot of people's mothers used to sing it to them. And it's like just trying to find your place in the world. And will I be pretty? Will I be rich? Like, those are the things to aspire to. You know, in our generation, that's what our mothers were singing to us. Mm. And it made me sad. And it also made me realize how far we have come. I would never have sung that to my daughters, you know. And I do believe in Que Sera Sera in life. What will be, you know. But those aren't the particular benchmarks we're looking for, like pretty and rich.
And it's done in a very particular way, too. Yes. In the beginning, the performers sing with this sort of little baby voice, little girly voice, and they're doing this little waltz around the stage. It's very seemingly innocent, because yeah. that's how they're indoctrinated, right? Yeah. And then there's a monologue, and then after the monologue, the women have grown up. And they sing with a heavier tone, and they sing as though they're singing a beer drinking song at a pub. Get a kiss, and a,
and that's a. Right.
It's very aggressive and it's powerful. Beautiful. It makes you see the journey of that. Like, this is what you were taught as a little girl, and then you grow up and you're a woman. Like, how do you deal with that? How does that affect you today? So it's really powerful to see not only the journey of music throughout the show, but the journey of music just within the scope of one song. Yeah. Is really cool. And so I'm glad you mentioned yeah. that, because that number in particular is very powerful.
When it gets to the song, because the phases that women go through is from codependent to anger, cynicism, and then inner strength. So girls just want to have fun, and Material Girl are cynicism songs. But when it gets to inner strength, the first one was Greatest Love of All, and it's sung with the kind of power that we finally had as women, instead of being that Que Sera or I Will Follow Him songs.
That was Anne Citrin, Ovi Vargas, and Dr. Dorothy Marsick speaking with our associate producer, Madeline Reynolds. Respect, This One's for the Girls, is running at the Phoenicia Playhouse in Phoenicia, New York from April 4th to the 13th. To learn more and find tickets, you can go to PhoeniciaPlayhouse.com. Thanks for listening to this week's 51%. 51% is a national production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio, based in Albany, New York. It's produced and hosted by me, Jesse King. Our associate producer is Madeline Reynolds, and our theme is Lolita by the Albany-based artist Girl Blue. Just a reminder that you can listen to 51% anytime at our website, wamcpodcast.org, or wherever you get your podcasts. And you can stay in the loop on all of WAMC's shows by signing up for our weekly newsletter, Airwaves, at wamc.org. We hope you'll join us next week. Until then, I'm Jesse King for 51%.
I was every single girl, I was nobody else, I was so sure of myself. I was 15 and a half, he was a hollow laugh. And I lost my cool somewhere along the way. At night and down the hallway, I had to learn how to look away. I lost my cool.